Good morning. This is August 18th, 2022, and this is Upfront. I'm Morningstar Galley, reporting from the Ohlone Bay. On today's show, we will be speaking about model legislation that may criminalize writing about abortion. We will also speak with Assemblymember James Ramos, the first California Indian legislator, on a number of bills making their way to the governor's office. All that is coming up next, after the news.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. The former chief financial officer of the Trump Organization is expected to plead guilty today in a New York courtroom to tax fraud charges. It's part of a deal Alan Weisselberg's attorney has worked out with prosecutors that would require him to testify about business practices at the former president's company. Weisselberg is charged with accepting more than $1.7 million in untaxed compensation. He's alleged to have accepted off-the-books compensation like rent, car payments, and school tuition. Weisselberg will have to speak in court about the company's role in the arrangement and possibly serve as a witness when the Trump Organization goes on trial in October. A federal judge today is expected to decide whether to unseal documents submitted to obtain the warrant to search former President Trump's Florida residence. Some of the country's largest media companies want the affidavit supporting the warrant made public. The Justice Department objects to the documents being released. The DOJ argues its investigation into Trump's possible mishandling of sensitive documents could be compromised. The media companies argue the affidavit's release would help the public determine if the Justice Department was justified in searching Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort. Trump has called for the release of the unredacted affidavit in the interest of transparency. Trump has copies of both the warrant and the itemized list of items seized and could release them at any time. He hasn't yet done so. The European Union today mediated talks between the leaders of Kosovo and Serbia aimed at easing tensions between the Balkan neighbors. Feature Story News' Rosie Burchard reports from Brussels.
The crisis talks mediated by the EU's foreign policy chief Josep Borrell were called after a dispute regarding license plates and identity documents resulted in violent protests in late July. Tensions eased after authorities in Pristina agreed to postpone implementation of new rules. Kosovo unilaterally declared independence from Serbia in 2008. Serbia slammed the move as illegal. Brussels has been mediating talks aimed at normalizing ties between Belgrade and Pristina for over a decade. Ahead of Thursday's meeting, Serbian President Aleksandar Vučić warned that discussions would be difficult.
Rosie Burchard, Brussels.
A bomb blast on a packed mosque in the Afghan capital Kabul today killed at least 21 people and wounded dozens of others. That's according to Afghan officials. No one's claimed responsibility, but ISIS has carried out similar attacks in the country. Feature Story News' Ollie Barrett reports.
Kabul police say the blast was caused by explosives that had been placed inside the mosque. Hospital workers in the Afghan capital say they've been treating victims suffering from shell and burn injuries, including a number of children. The explosion happened during crowded evening prayers, and it's reported the mosque's imam is among those killed. Taliban security forces are at the scene of the attack, which has now been sealed off. Intelligence officials say their investigation is underway. Nearby buildings were rocked by the large explosion. This latest incident comes a week after ISIS militants killed a pro-Taliban cleric in Kabul in a suicide attack. The Islamic State group continues to be a major security challenge for the Taliban a year after they took the Afghan capital. I'm Ollie Barrett.
The head of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is shaking up the organization with the goal of making it more nimble. The plan changes at the nation's largest public health organization come amid criticism of the agency's response to COVID-19, monkeypox, and other public health threats. CDC leaders are calling it a reset. The changes include internal staffing moves and steps to speed up data releases. The CDC's director told the agency's staff about the changes on Wednesday. She says it's a CDC initiative and was not directed by the White House or other administration officials. Momentum is growing for establishing term limits for Supreme Court justices. A recent poll found that 2 in 3 Americans support limiting how long a justice can serve. And bills have been introduced in Congress to make it a law. More from Public News Service's Edwin J. Vieira.
The Supreme Court Tenure Establishment and Retirement Modernization, or TERM Act, would subject justices to 18-year term limits, after which they would be retired. The bill comes at a time when confidence in the Supreme Court fell to 25% in June, according to a Gallup poll. This is down from 36% at the same time in 2021. Georgia Representative Hank Johnson introduced the bill and feels this could keep the court relevant with the American state of mind.
Our Supreme Court is not accountable to the people in its present configuration, and so therefore term limits will help to infuse modern thinking and keep the United States Supreme Court a modern branch of our democracy.
Should Congress approve the bill, five of the current justices would be retired from the court throughout the next 6 years. I'm Edwin J. Vieira.
Restoration efforts are working to preserve Mendocino's once thriving kelp forests as efforts to control the purple sea urchin are bearing fruit. More from Public News Service's Mary Sherman.
The kelp forests off the Mendocino coast in California are starting to recover with improved environmental conditions and thanks to a conservation program that sent divers to remove 45,000 pounds of invasive purple sea urchins. The urchins have devastated the once massive bull kelp forests, leaving a lifeless barren behind. Dan Abbott with the Reef Check Foundation says this is the first large-scale kelp restoration project of its kind in Northern California.
We will use the funds to redesign our website, to have activities on our campus to engage adult learners. We're also looking at murals on our campus to create that sense of belonging.
The purple sea urchin population has exploded in the last 8 years or so, partially because a wasting disease has decimated their chief predator, the sea star. Mary Sherman reporting.
A new report out today from the city of San Francisco estimates that as many as 20,000 people in the city will be homeless this year. The report also concludes that for every one person housed by a city program, four people will become unhoused. However, the report also shows the most significant headway in 17 years in reducing overall homelessness in San Francisco. The new data is contained in the city's full point in time count. It expands on a summary report released in May, which showed that San Francisco saw a 3.5% decrease in homelessness over 3 years. That number reflects a one-night count versus the 20,000 number over the course of a full year. The count, normally taken up every 2 years to qualify for federal funding, was conducted in one night in February. The last tally was done in 2019, but the city skipped a year because of the pandemic. Sunny today in the Bay Area, highs in the 80s and 90s, lows tonight in the 60s. In the central San Joaquin Valley, sunny and hot, highs 105. I'm Max Pringle. News returns at 7:30 on KPFA.
The time is 7:08 in the morning. You're listening to Upfront. I'm Morningstar Galley. As Roe v. Wade was overturned on June 24, 2022, California abortion clinics have been greatly impacted, with many in need of medical services that are traveling from out-of-state regions. This has created a challenge for medical service providers as abortion funding and services are strained and as they are trying to meet the growing need for capacity. This is also greatly affecting journalists reporting on these issues. Mother Jones and Rewire News Group sent a letter, co-signed by 24 news outlets and press freedom groups, to U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland, voicing concerns about conservatives pushing state-level legislation that could threaten press freedoms and criminalize news outlets and reporters for posting stories perceived to be helping someone access abortion care. In supporting those in need of abortion access in California, and also reporting on this nightmare ruling, this is affecting many that are advocating against the many constitutional rights-based violations when it comes to medical treatment. The press release states that 26 news outlets, press freedom groups, urge the U.S. Department of Justice to protect reporters from anti-abortion legislation. In the letter, they include two specific requests of Garland: to publicly reiterate the press freedoms granted under the First Amendment, and remind states that they cannot infringe on those rights when news outlets write about abortion, and to intervene if any state enacts such a law by using the agency's authority to halt the overall law from taking effect, or provisions that may punish news organizations and reporters. On with us this morning is Johanna Berry, the Chief Operating Officer at Mother Jones, and Galena Espinosa, Editor-in-Chief of Rewire News Groups. Welcome, Johanna and Galena.
Good morning. Good to be here.
Good morning to you both. Share with us the constitutional rights violations that journalists are facing. Johanna, we'll start with you.
Thank you so much. We have a history in this country of being able to speak freely and to publish information that the public wants and needs. So if lawmakers today can tell people they can't read abortion stories, then the next day it could be stories about sexual orientation, immigration, or racial justice. It's a really slippery and troubling slope.
And Galina.
Yes, and I think what's perhaps most concerning is that for all those folks who think this could never happen because freedom of the press is, of course, enshrined in the Constitution, folks felt that same way about Roe v. Wade, which was, determined to be protected by the U.S. Constitution for nearly 50 years. And we saw in June the Supreme Court overturn that. And I think that when you think about, the legal chaos that decision has unleashed, it's really emboldened, the same forces who overturned Roe to now go after other rights that are constitutionally protected. And I think that while they are starting with freedom of the press, I don't think it's going to end there.
Share with us that how is it that freedom of the press can be protected when it comes to reporting on medical access and treatment?
Well, one of the things we're asking for in this letter is for the Department of Justice to get involved. The Department of Justice regularly gets involved when states overstep the law and trample on the rights of people. So, for example, earlier this month, the Department of Justice sued the state of Idaho to stop new anti-abortion law. And this past April, it sued the state of Alabama to stop its new anti-transgender law. But we don't have to wait for a state law to take effect. The Department of Justice right now could firmly say no state has the right to dictate what stories news outlets can write and post online.
And it is important to be proactive and to get out in front of this. Already one state legislature, the one in South Carolina, has pre-filed legislation that would, in fact, attempt to limit the ability of journalism outlets to report on abortion. So we know that this is something that's being talked about. We know that this is something that is coming. Now is the time to take a stand and make clear that freedom of the press cannot be violated.
I think
Share
one additional point.
No, go ahead and finish.
One additional point I wanted to make is that this law not only applies to the press, it also applies to ordinary people. And the punishment for, as the proposed law calls, aiding and abetting abortion is 25 years in prison. So that would apply to both news organizations and someone who just shared information, even if they're not in the state of South Carolina, if the information is used by someone in South Carolina. So the law is quite broad and quite troubling.
And that's by design, right, Johanna? I mean, this is really where we're seeing anti-abortion efforts go. We saw that in Texas last fall when it passed its SB8 law, known familiarly as the Bounty Hunter Law, which not only, targets, patients and providers, but then expands beyond that to target anyone who can be identified as, quote unquote, aiding or abetting someone get an abortion. And that language is really vague. It's really broad. And that's on purpose. That's to not only, restrict, kind of limit folks from getting involved, but also to strike fear into people, to make people think twice. And that's what's happening here with these efforts against the press. It's also, the language is deliberately vague. And that's to get news organizations thinking twice about, so much as publishing the word abortion. And that's incredibly chilling.
We have been speaking with Johanna Berry, Chief Operating Officer at Mother Jones, and Galina Espinoza, Editor-in-Chief of Rewire News Group. Thank you both for joining us this morning. I'm curious to know, what support have you received? I know this letter was just published in the last few days, but can you speak on support that's been received in publishing this?
This is Johnny here at Mother Jones. From our perspective, we were really glad to see that so many news organizations have signed on and support. So already 24 news organizations and press freedom groups have signed on in support, and also some of them have also published stories in support. But right now, the letter is only a couple of days old, and so we're looking forward, hopefully, to hearing from the Department of Justice as well.
And I think for us at Rewire News Group, it was really important to raise awareness at this moment. So many of the folks with whom we share this letter, our supporters, our audience, were not aware that this was even something that was happening. So I think from an awareness raising standpoint, this was a really pivotal move forward. And our hope is as more folks become aware of this, and as we elevate this conversation, action will be taken.
In terms of the action taken, have you been aware of, waiting on a response from the Department of Justice? Has there been any conversation on there being a response to this?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand the question.
In terms of waiting on a response from the Department of Justice, have you heard anything yet from them?
No, not yet.
Nor us either. But like Jonna said, this is still pretty early days. And, our hope is to continue to call attention to this issue and keep it front of mind.
I'm curious to know, in terms of the organizing that took place behind this letter and bringing the journalists together to publish this news release, is this something that you have come across before in terms of this Supreme Court ruling? What does that look like at this time? Are there other examples that you can provide in terms of the proposal for this letter to be published?
I'm so glad you asked that. This is someplace that we've been before as a country. Before Roe v. Wade, the lawsuit, there was actually a legal case about this very issue where a managing editor of a news organization called the Virginia Weekly actually published a advertisement that told people in Virginia how they could get access to medical care for abortions in a different state. And ultimately, the Supreme Court actually ruled that it was not proper for that managing editor be charged with a misdemeanor for providing that information. It was protected by the First Amendment. So pre-Roe v. Wade, it used to be illegal for news organizations to actually spread information about abortion or contraception. So in this law that's moving forward in South Carolina, this proposed law, we're actually rolling back the clock, not only on Roe v. Wade, but also the First Amendment protections that protected speech around abortion.
And even looking back even further to the 1800s, back in 1873, Congress passed the Comstock Act, in which birth control was declared to be obscene, and under anti-obscenity laws, it made it a crime to not only disseminate contraception through the mail or across state lines, but also information about birth control. And it took almost 100 years for the Supreme Court to recognize the rights of single people to use contraception, and that was in 1972. So when you think about how backwards we're going with all of these issues, you can go all the way back to 1873 to see these kinds of conversations and this kind of action being taken against the sharing of information about birth control and abortion, which are play a vital part in women's lives. I think it's worth reminding folks that one out of four women will have an abortion by the age of 25, by the age of 45. That's 25% of women. So this is something that is part and parcel of most women's reproductive journeys. And to think that we're trying to potentially criminalize the sharing of information about this is truly alarming.
It is truly alarming. Let's talk about the financial impacts and implications. In the press release, it states that Mother Jones spent $2.5 million over 2 years to fend off a lawsuit by a conservative billionaire who disliked how he was depicted in one of their 2012 stories. What impacts are you seeing now in terms of how that will play out with the Roe v. Wade ruling?
You know, I'm really glad you brought that up. At Mother Jones, between us and our insurance company, we actually spent $3 million defending a lawsuit that was brought by a wealthy conservative individual who did not agree with how he was depicted in a story. And we're keenly aware that deep-pocketed conservative organizations and wealthy individuals routinely use lawsuits and criminal penalties in order to create legal cases that cost thousands or millions of dollars to defend. And it's quite possible for a news organization that's independent, that doesn't have a corporate sponsor, to be shut down because they can't afford to defend themselves against a legal action, even if maybe down the line they may prevail. And this could be also a devastating cost that could be borne even by individual people. Remember, this law that's being proposed in South Carolina could apply to a news organization, it could apply to a library, it even covers phone conversations that could lead to an abortion. So imagine as an individual having to raise money to defend yourself in a criminal case in another state because information you share potentially could have been used to sway someone to have an abortion procedure.
And I think that's really, you know, the not so subtle subtext of this model law that is being talked about. This idea that, you know, anyone publishing, sharing information that could be interpreted as having aided or abetted an abortion. I mean, what does that even mean? You know, the premise is that this is a way of ensuring, you know, that the laws are not being violated. But in reality, they are trying to bankrupt news organizations. They are trying to silence and shut down the sharing of information about abortion, about birth control. And I think that should be concerning to anyone who cares about freedom of the press and the important role that press autonomy plays in a healthy democracy.
We have been speaking with the chief operating officer of Mother Jones, and I'm sorry, the chief operating officer at Mother Jones, Jonna Berry, and Galina Espinosa, the editor-in-chief of Rewire News Group. Thank you both for being on with us this morning and covering such an important topic. I'm wondering if you both, we just have a few minutes left here, and if you both have any follow-up statements.
I think it's just really important that that people know that we really have to take this threat to public information very seriously. You know, we have a history of being able to speak freely and publish information that the public wants and needs. And I think it's just really important that people safeguard their own civil rights by reaching out to their congressperson for them to reach out to the Department of Justice, because this is just a very serious and concerning issue that impacts so many people.
Truly, this is a line in the sand that we have to draw. And that's why I'm so, you know, thrilled to have worked with Mother Jones on this and with all of the other organizations that co-signed the letter. I think it's really important for journalism as a profession, as a pillar of a free society, for all of us to really kind of band together and make clear that these kinds of laws that may target, you know, right now one segment of the press, this really does affect all of us, and we need to present a unified front and not let this stand.
And how is it for our listening audience, how is it that the general public can support with Mother Jones, with Rewire, for these efforts in protecting both freedom of the press and constitutional rights when it comes to medical care and treatment?
As I mentioned earlier, I think that people should definitely contact their representatives. I think they should, you know, make their thoughts known to Department of Justice. But also it's important for them to keep an eye on their state legislature. So many of these laws will be popping up in other states that have banned abortion. And so it's really important as a citizen to keep watch on that and to talk to your state representatives and know that this is not legislation you would support.
I second all of that. I mean, I think what's been so exciting and inspiring in these weeks after the Supreme Court's decision overturning Roe has been to see how engaged the public in and how vocal the public has been in registering their dissatisfaction and making clear that the court's decision did not reflect the majority of the public's values. And I think now it's really about maintaining that momentum, you know, not losing sight that this is a long game, that this is, you know, something that is only going to get worse most likely before it gets better. And it's important to stay engaged, to stay committed, and to keep raising your voice.
We have been speaking on model legislation that may criminalize writing about abortion with Jonna Berry of Mother Jones and Galena Espinosa of Rewire News Group. Thank you both for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for calling attention to this issue.
We will now go to a story on the 10 years of DACA, where immigrant rights advocates are celebrating the 10-year anniversary of DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival program that protects undocumented people brought to the U.S. as children from deportation.
CHILA, the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights, is holding a week-long legal clinic in Los Angeles to celebrate the 10-year anniversary of DACA, the federal program that has helped young undocumented immigrants remain in the country they call home. Areli Hernandez, a volunteer with CHILA, says she'll be helping out all week at the legal clinic. She says DACA recipients should renew their DACA status at least 6 months in advance to ensure they don't end up being left out of the program.
But also we are looking at what else can be done for everyone else, for DACA, TPS, and those that don't qualify for these programs. And one of the things we're working on is updating the registry. The registry date is a date that exists already in immigration law. And it's almost like an expiration date that says you waited long enough, you can now apply for a green card.
Due to legal challenges to DACA, the federal government is not processing new applicants. Hernandez says there is a registry that has not been updated since 1986. The registry states that if you arrived before 1972, you can apply for a green card. But the near 600,000 DACA recipients who were brought to the U.S. as children after 1972 and grew up here hang in the balance, awaiting a ruling to a legal challenge to DACA filed by Texas and eight Republican-leading states. A panel of Republican judges at the Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit in New Orleans heard the challenge last month. They were Chief Judge Priscilla Richmond, an appointee of President George W. Bush, and two Donald Trump appointees, James C. Ho and Judge Kurt Engelhard. With much uncertainty, Hernandez shares some final words for undocumented people.
Find a community. That's the one thing that you can do. Find community, find people that will be your partners and that will really help you and build healthy relationships. I come from the generation that was undocumented and very afraid. And one thing I learned in the movement is that the fear is reasonable, but it doesn't mean we have to live in it every day, that we can live in our freedom.
DACA has faced numerous court challenges since then President Barack Obama created it by executive order in 2012. Former President Donald Trump moved to end the program, but a U.S. Supreme Court decision determined that he had not done it properly, bringing it back to life and allowing for new applications. Since then, Texas led a lawsuit against it, once again putting the lives of hundreds of thousands in limbo. I'm Pamela Estrada for KPFA.
And that takes us to 7:31 in the morning. I am Morningstar Galley, and this is Up Front. Next, we will go to an interview with Assemblymember James Ramos. After the news.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. A federal judge today is expected to decide whether to unseal documents submitted to obtain the warrant to search former President Trump's Florida residence. Some of the country's largest media companies want the affidavit supporting the warrant made public. The Justice Department objects to the documents being released, however. The DOJ argues its investigation into Trump's possible mishandling of sensitive documents could be compromised. A bomb blast in a packed mosque in the Afghan capital, Kabul, today killed at least 21 people and wounded dozens of others. That's according to Afghan officials. No one has claimed responsibility, but ISIS has carried out similar attacks in the country. Feature Story News' Ollie Barrett reports.
Kabul police say the blast was caused by explosives that had been placed inside the mosque. Hospital workers in the Afghan capital say they've been treating victims suffering from shell and burn injuries, including a number of children. The explosion happened during crowded evening prayers, and it's reported the mosque's imam is among those killed. Taliban security forces are at the scene of the attack, which has now been sealed off. Intelligence officials say their investigation is underway. Nearby buildings were rocked by the large explosion. This latest incident comes a week after ISIS militants killed a pro-Taliban cleric in Kabul in a suicide attack. The Islamic State group continues to be a major security challenge for the Taliban a year after they took the Afghan capital. I'm Ollie Barrett.
The days of the thundering engine noise coming from muscle cars are coming to an end. Carmaker Dodge has announced it will no longer be manufacturing its well-known gas-powered muscle cars in the next few years. The company announced it's officially moving to electricity. On Wednesday night, the automaker unveiled a battery-powered Charger Daytona concept car. One like it will be in showrooms in 2024 as the sun sets on some gas-powered models. Other automakers are moving or have moved in the same direction. It's part of their effort to move away from greenhouse gas producing fossil fuels. Sunny today in the San Francisco Bay Area, highs in the 80s and 90s, lows tonight in the 60s. In the central San Joaquin Valley, sunny and hot, highs around 105. I'm Max Pringle. News returns at 8 on KPFA.
And I'm Morningstar Galley for Upfront. Since the founding of California as a state in 1850, through state-sponsored genocide and legislation of California Indian peoples, California Indian tribes and tribal peoples have been targeted. It is now 2022, and Assemblymember James Ramos, a member of the Serrano and Cuya tribe, is the first California Indian to be elected to the California State Assembly. We will now go to an interview with Assemblymember Ramos. This is Morningstar Galley with Upfront. With us this morning is Assemblymember James Ramos, a member of the Serrano Cuya tribe. State Assemblymember Ramos is the first California Indian to be elected to the California State Assembly.
He is a lifelong resident of the San Manuel Indian Reservation in San Bernardino County. His district includes the cities of Highland, Loma Linda, Rancho Cucamonga, Redlands, and San Bernardino. Chimisenwi, thank you for joining us this morning, Assemblymember Ramos.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
I know you've been very busy during bill season. Share with our listeners your experience as the first California Indian Assembly member.
So as being the first legislator from California Indian Tribe, there's a lot of issues that still have gone unknown to many legislature and even here in the state of California to the California Indian people. So we work hard on raising the awareness, advocacy, culture, and adding our voice into an area that's been absent inside these chambers for over 170 years. So we tackle a lot of bills on tribal issues, but we also tackle a lot of bills for our district itself.
Assemblymember Ramos has been representing the 40th District in the California State Assembly since 2018. And was just reelected. Congratulations on your reelection. Can you share some of the bills that your office has been working on?
Certainly. Some of our bills that we've worked on specifically for Indian Country for the tribal communities, we're currently working on a bill, AB 1923, on government-to-government consultation. That bill is now on the Senate side, getting ready to be heard and voted on. A bill that we just got word today, Senator Monique Lamon jockeyed that for me on the Senate floor, AB 1703, the California Indian Education Act, moved off the Senate floor, so it's a step closer to the governor to getting signed. And what that bill will do is start to pave the way for the factual history, history that sometimes the state has not been so open to discuss, history that includes genocide and atrocities, because we need to make sure that that part of history is something that's being talked about and acknowledged rather than not acknowledging it and trying to move forward. So we continue to work on those issues. AB 1703 will be headed to the governor, so we could encourage those to write letters of support to get that bill signed. We've also worked on, and with yourself, Morningstar, testifying on AB 2022, the S word, making sure that derogatory names towards our Native American women is something that the state of California wouldn't stand for. And that bill is also ready to be heard on the Senate floor. We've also moved on a bill that calls for an alert system for missing and murdered Indigenous persons from tribal reservations and Indian communities. And we're calling it the Feather Alert, and it's AB 1314. And that bill also has been 28-8 to go straight to the Senate floor that will then be headed to the governor. That's just a snapshot of the bills that we continue to work on here for our people here in the state of California. But I would be remiss if I didn't mention here in this interview that we need more California Indian people elected into the state legislature and all bodies within the jurisdictions of the state of California to make sure our voice is being heard.
Yes, you are one voice that has been championing for all of us, and we are very grateful for that. But we definitely need those voices heard, and we need the support. In terms of the epidemic of missing and murdered Indigenous persons, there was a press conference that was held with the Attorney General's office, and the allocation of funding to tribal lands and areas. Can you speak about the passage of that bill and that funding allocation that took place in last year's bill cycle?
Definitely. AB 3099 deals with missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls on Indian reservations and now expanding into persons. It brings the Attorney General into the fold because we need to find out why many of those cases aren't being solved or even looked at in the state of California. When we did some research, and with your help, Morningstar, we were able to identify that the state of California is number 7th on the list of unsolved cases dealing with Indigenous persons from the state of California. So we ended up moving AB 3099, and we got funding to fund those positions within the Attorney General's office. And then we had another hearing on the on that day. We had that press conference that brought to light the Amber Alert, the Silver Alert, why there wasn't an alert for Indigenous persons here in the state of California. We quickly went to work, and within a month, we had a bill ready to go in the state legislature, and that's the Feather Alert bill that we believe will be heading to the governor here by the end of this week.
Yes, and that bill is AB 1314, the Feather Alert bill. We were able to participate in the press conference, and I know the opportunity in working directly with family members that have been impacted, that have had their loved ones go missing, that have had their loved ones murdered, being able to just have that opportunity of being a part of the policymaking, being a part of the visibility and the change making. A lot of these efforts we've spoken about previously, that this is the efforts of truth and healing. This is the efforts of there's no way to rectify the genocide that has happened to California peoples, but this is one step forward. Can you speak to that, please?
Certainly. I think one of the bills that we introduced last session and they got signed into law was AB 338 that dealt with the mission colonization period, where the Junipero Serra statue here on the Capitol grounds in Sacramento came down during a protest. We wrote letters to joint rules and rules where I sat on rules at that particular time, asking that meaningful dialogue should come into discussion with California Indian people on why it's so offensive. That didn't go anywhere. So we introduced a bill. We're a state legislator. We introduced AB 338, went through, and we ended up having some heavy debate here in the state legislature and educating people on the atrocities and infliction upon California Indians people from the mission colonization period, that ultimately 338 moved through both houses of the legislature and was signed into law. And what that bill does, it calls on the local tribes here in the Sacramento area. We had a good sponsorship with them coming forward from the Miwok Nisenan people. And they've agreed recently, complying with the bill, to have a statue erected. And we're planning on November having a groundbreaking for that statue to come up on these Capitol grounds. And that's a big testimony, because then when the school-age children come through the Capitol to learn about the history of the state, now we're going to have a tribal presence on the Capitol grounds itself to ensure that they're hearing the true story and the true history of our people during the Gold Rush, during the mission colonization, and that would lead to bigger discussion on the different rancherias, the different reservation systems, and how a lot of tribes were relocated into different areas. I think that still is part of the educational process that still needs to happen.
Prior to the Junipero Serra statue being removed, there was also efforts made of the removal of the Columbus and Queen Isabella statue being removed from the state capitol rotunda. And so I know that in terms of the classroom visits that you mentioned, that was really, where it was positioned in such an important area. Can you speak to that also?
Definitely. They happened within the same time period. I'm happy to report that statue is no longer in the rotunda. If members come through the rotunda, they'll see an empty space that's there. And so it was very enlightening for me as an Indian person to see that statue removed because of the oppression that was brought to us by not just here in the United States, but across the world by the Spanish and those and indigenous people, different turmoil that happened. Here in the state of California, we know that the mission system carries that stronger burden for us here in the state and the history, but it starts to heal a lot of trauma that has taken place. And for a lot of the things that we deal with, symbolism is a big issue. For many, Columbus served as that symbol of deterioration of cultures and people and language. So I think we're on a track to engage in the educational system, to teach about what truly happened here in the state of California that then spreads to the rest of the state, similar to the boarding schools. And we jumped and we're supporting that with the Secretary of Interior, Deb Haaland, on those issues here in the state of California.
Thank you. Share with our listeners some reflections that you have had over the last 4 years. I know that Member Garcia has mentioned that, you know, they would come across, you know, some of the issues for California Indian peoples here and there, but there, you know, there wasn't this momentum, there wasn't this push that is happening now. And so can you share over the last 4 years the changes that you've seen occur and what still needs to occur?
I think representation matters. I mean, certainly to have, and people talk about COVID, during COVID, talking about vaccines and trying to get vaccines out to people in the state of California. And then hearing while we were in our caucus meetings that Native American women were resistant to take the vaccine. And people didn't understand why. And I said, well, you know, there was a sterilization policy inflicted upon Native American women here in the state of California as late as the 1970s. And no one even knew that. And so that started to bring to light a lot of the educational process that still needs to happen. A lot of the issues that Assemblywoman Christina Garcia, who chairs the Women's Caucus, we partnered on a lot of issues. I'm moving forward. The S word is one of those that we've actually partnered with to get that moving, as well as the Feather Alert. As a matter of fact, Senator Skinner is going to be presenting a jockeying on the Senate floor, the S word bill for us. So what truly is happening, and that's why representation matters. That's why we need more Native American people elected into these bodies, is because then you start to gain allies with the Women's Caucus, allies with the Latino Caucus, allies with constituents, right, that are in our communities, that start to see that these issues should have been addressed many years ago. And it's always been that way, at least for me, growing up on the Samoa Indian Reservation. I served there in tribal politics since 1996, ultimately to tribal chairman, then on the County Board of Supervisors for San Bernardino County, Community College Board, trustees, State Board of Education. But everywhere we go, it always is another re-educational process, right? We do so much to educate people in our area about the factual sights and sounds of our songs, Kuya bird songs, Serrano Bighorn sheep songs. Our housing is not teepees, it's more of a, you know, willow-framed homes. We educate people till we're exhausted. And every role that we step into is the whole educational process all over again. That's why I think we have to encourage others to get engaged. We've been introducing pieces of legislation that start to fill that gap and that voice that's there. We deal with foster care and Native American families. I know ICWA is under attack, so we need to make sure that there's funding to withstand that within the legal aspect. But we have to ask ourselves, and this is what sometimes draws some criticism or whatever, but if we're still battling with the issues that faced our people back in the 60s, 70s, foster care, housing, we had a hearing here that I, with my Select Committee on Native American Affairs, found out that Tule River is still going with substandard water, drinking water for their people. And that could be the same mess, the same issue that other tribes are dealing with. Yet we see millions of dollars moving towards different initiatives. If we just got a half of that to solve some of these problems, maybe we could actually start to get into the history books, get into the issues of missing and murdered Indigenous women. Why? And it's great to have the Feather Alert and all that moving, but why did it take till 2022 to get that moving? We're happy to do the work, don't get me wrong, but if we came together as a people to really address the issues that are plaguing our people, that would make us so much stronger and so much ahead of the game. We're still dealing with things. ICWA was under attack. That was there to ensure that our children were given to Native American families to retain their culture. Now it's being challenged by those in Texas that are saying that non-Native families should be at the forefront before Native families are actually addressed or given the opportunity for Native American kids when dealing with foster care. make no mistake, those issues that we fought about that we grew up in the 60s, 70s are still facing us today. And I think those are the issues that we need to come together and start to address. We're doing our part, hopefully, here in the state legislature, identifying Indian education, derogatory names, right? Foster care, that compensation to foster care families, Native American families, to upgrade their homes so they could get checked off the box by the county and different jurisdictions to be that foster care family. When others outside of Native American country get that compensation, why is our people last in line?
For our listeners that may not be aware of what ICWA stands for, can you explain what the Indian Child Welfare Act is and what efforts are taking place in California in terms of protecting ICWA?
So ICWA, Indian Child Welfare Act, was actually implemented to protect Native American children from losing their identity and culture, because over the assimilation policies of the United States, Indian kids were taken from Indian families and then they were raised by non-Native families, losing their culture, losing their identity. And so ICWA was created to ensure that never happens again, that now when Indian children are in foster care system, that they would first come back to the culture, and there'd be open families in the Native American communities to be that family for them, to retain the culture and to ensure that they have their identity that was taken from them from the United States. Now, in Texas, there's been a lawsuit filed against ICWA that says that shouldn't be the first case of sending Native American kids to a Native American family, that non-Native families should be also in the front line to be foster care parents for those individuals. And so, but ICWA is there to engage our people, have a culture, their identity, and to make sure to reverse that assimilation process that's there. It's under attack. It's going to be heard by the Supreme Court. I'm just not sure when. So in California, we're trying to rally the troops to make sure that people understand how important that is. And it's always been an issue, even sitting on the County Board of Supervisors, to get the local court systems to even acknowledge that that law was in existence. So these are the issues that are important to our people here in Indian country. And as a Serrano Cahuilla person, I use interchangeably Indian country and Native American people. But these are the issues that are pressing on our people. I see other things that are going on, but we're battling in the budget and we're successful. We got $5 million going towards some of these areas. We got a couple million dollars going towards some of these. But if we came together as a people and we got all the leadership to say this is important, we could get in this budget in the state of California far more than that $5 million or $2.5 million that we got for some of these issues. Don't get me wrong, we've done great. I mean, we've been able to get $5 million towards SYNC to become the first federally accredited tribal college here in the state of California. When other states outside of California already have 2 to 3, California is home to more individual Native Americans than any other state in the nation, yet we have no federally accredited tribal college. So the state of California has awarded $5 million towards that cause. And a lot of our budget requests, specifically towards Native American issues, we got well over $27 million from the state budget, which fares well for a legislator.
I'll just share that from what we are hearing and following the upcoming ruling from the Supreme Court, we have a date of November 9th, possibly, for the ICWA ruling. So we will keep our listeners aware and keep them updated as we get closer to that date. Just want to spend the last few minutes speaking about AB 2022, the removal of the S word. Much of the public isn't aware that there are over 95 public place names that still include the S word throughout California, that this is not a word that is respectful to Native American women, that, you know, even like you said, this is 2022 and we're still, you know, having to go and testify and say, you know, that this is a word that is not respectful, that it is demeaning, that it is, you know, not something that we want our children to have to experience in terms of, you know, the racial, the racial place names, you know, and how that affects our youth, how that continues to affect our communities. Can you speak on that?
Oh, definitely. I mean, yourself included testified on this bill, but we also had several youth come up from reservation Southern California, Saboba Reservation, San Manuel, and the youth were saying how derogatory it is towards them. And when you grow up on the Indian reservation, you face so many obstacles, but yet to have a derogatory name still hurled at you. And then with the historical trauma that you know happened within history, but still with the energy to look past those and move forward shows the resiliency and the strongness of our people. We're still here. We're sitting in the state legislature, and yeah, we're tackling these bills. And it's ironic that AB 2022, in the year 2022, we're dealing with derogatory names towards Native American women. Once this bill is signed into law, the state of California will come into parity with the federal government that already has called out federal place names to get removed. This will bring it full circle here in the state of California. I believe we could be one of the first states to implement this and come in parity with the federal government. And you would think that people would be open to get rid of this name, but we know that there's some that have dug in and are resistant to the name change itself. But now it takes a piece of a legislation to present that. And because we're sitting in the state legislature as a California Indian person, we will cherish and we will champion these types of bills to ensure that our ancestors and elders know that what they went through is not falling on deaf ears.
This is Morningstar Gelly for Upfront. We have been speaking with Assemblymember James Ramos, representing the 40th District. Sisulayi, thank you so much to Assemblymember James Ramos for joining us this morning. And that does it for today's Upfront program. Kat Brooks is the host of KPFA's newest show, Law and Disorder, airing weekdays at 8 a.m. We air weekday mornings on Upfront at 7 a.m. We post information about our topics and our guests online at kpfa.org, where you can also dig through our archives, subscribe to the show as a podcast, and connect to us on social media. If you'd like to give us feedback on something you've heard or suggest something for us to cover, send us an email, upfront@kpfa.org. A big thanks to everyone that makes this show happen, producers Chris Lee and Scott Baba, engineer Kirsten Thomas. I am Morningstar Galley, filling in for Brian Edwards Teekert. Thanks to Mitch Jeserich and Eileen Alfandari. If you are incarcerated and would like to write, write to Upfront, KPFA, 1929 MLK Way, Berkeley, California, 94704. Stay up and stay tuned. Kat Brooks' all-new show, Law & Disorder, is coming your way next at 8 a.m.
The United Nations Association East Bay Chapter welcomes nominations of individuals and organizations making exemplary impacts on safe drinking water, sanitation, healthy water-based ecosystems, drought, and more. Awards take place at the 2022 Global Citizens Awards celebration in October 2022. Nominations are invited by August 20th. For specifics related to award criteria, procedure, and judging, visit unausaeastbay.org. The community calendar is produced by the First Voice Apprenticeship Program. Please send your wheelchair accessibility listing to calendar@kpfa.org. To see this listing, visit kpfa.org.
Do you want to know what's going on around KPFA? On the Deck is the monthly video announcement series hosted by me, Miko Tolliver, where I give you program updates, info on our live events calendar, and interviews about show host and station history. Visit the front page of our station website at www.kpfa.org and stay current on all things KPFA.
You're listening to 94.1 KPFA, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley.
KFCF 88.1 FM in Fresno.
97.5 K248BR in Santa Cruz.
And online worldwide.
Worldwide.
Worldwide at kpfa.org.